Hi, I'm Brian Lay.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
And this is the Diversify Our Narrative podcast. Welcome to the April episode, our penultimate episode for Elizabeth and my season. This episode is all about teachers because what is the education system without the workers themselves?
Yeah. Happy anniversary, Brian. I'm excited for this episode. Per usual, though, with teachers, there are too many things to discuss. So we've decided to talk about a few somewhat related topics today, ranging from pedagogical tools to the teaching crisis.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot in this episode. Some of it, I feel like we really can't do justice. Like, teachers' unions are a huge conversation. But hopefully this serves as a good, you know, introduction to all this stuff. And it's hard to believe it's been almost a year for us. By the time this comes out, it'll literally be 11 months of doing this.
Yeah. And I also feel like, I mean, every episode relates to every other episode in a bunch of nuanced ways. But I think with teachers, it really does touch so many things that we've talked about in past episodes because they are like the core of the school system, of the education system. I mean, students are something, of course, it's what the education system affects. And I feel like students get missed a lot in conversations about what's going on in education, but so do the teachers. I think a lot of conversation has to do with curriculum, whether it be like critical race theory or charter schools or whatever's going on like a political level, but like talking about the students and the teachers often gets missed. So I'm excited for this episode.
Yeah. Okay, great. Let's get started because there's a lot to talk about. So starting off, we're going to start really esoteric. And Bell Hooks has this great book. It's called Teaching to Transgress. And it's basically all about education that actually liberates students. And there's an article in the Perspectives on Urban Education, which is titled One Teacher's Path to Progressive Pedagogy. And the author uses Bell Hooks' book to deconstruct her way of teaching. It's basically a case study that can translate really well to teachers, and I thought it'd be a good introduction to this section called Progressive Pedagogy.
Yeah, I think this is a good place to start. So the article wrestles with how progressive pedagogy mandates the equalization of power between students and teachers, as defined by Bell Hooks. Basically, how can we teach students without hierarchy of teacher and the teacher and the student, which is already a really interesting dynamic. I feel like we don't have relationships in our lives that are akin to teacher-student. So to like level that playing field would also be a really interesting thing to explore.
Yeah. And as we talk, it may seem more and more radical, but it actually makes a lot of sense as we sort of conclude the section. But the author writes about three myths. One, that children require constant control. Two, that children require constant surveillance. And three, that children require teachers to think for them.
So myth number one, that children require constant control. In this case, the author talks about how she would implement total participation techniques, which are techniques meant to get all students to participate. She would keep tallies of girls and boys she called on to ensure equal opportunity for gender equality. She would call on quiet students and calm, relatively talkative students, or rather than calm and really talkative students. And she would reprimand mean behavior that would discourage participation, which seems like good. This seems like relatively normal for what would happen in a classroom, if not more considerate than I feel like some teachers put into how they direct a classroom environment.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely intentional, especially the gender equality part. But children do not require constant control. And if you're trying to create, you know, even if you're trying to create that equitable environment, so instead, the author talks about how she should have let go of that need for a controlled environment and let the students share in that power. An example could have been she could have communicated what she expected. For example, boys should not dominate the conversation over girls and vice versa. And then after communicating that, let the students work together to make sure that goal happens.
Right. And it seems like a simple idea, yet it feels really risky in an environment where we put so much authority in the role of the teacher. The second myth, that children require constant surveillance, is something we're all familiar with, whether it be bathroom passes or internet restrictions on computers. Students, especially low-income students, are always told that they are incapable of exercising or learning how to regulate themselves. They need to be quote-unquote monitored, which I feel like relates so much to like the policing that we talked about in our last episode in terms of prison to school pipeline, that there needs to be like extra surveillance around because kids right. are going to do something.
Yeah. And that idea, you know, the rebuttal to that idea is negative consequences don't necessarily always snowball into crises. Like consequences can be a super valuable learning experience. If a student plagiarizes, you can just ask them to redo the paper. And restricting internet activity doesn't really change what they do at home. So that isn't necessarily the most effective thing to do. You're just policing students and their behavior. And if a student posts something online, we should provide the tools to navigate the online space safely and to help them protect themselves from harmful people. And I don't know, this all sort of makes sense when you think about it, but it's so scary because you're like, what are the kids going to do? What happens to them? But it's like for, you know, thousands of years, children have learned to live life through experience and through consequence.
Right. It is like this whole distrust of kids. I also think that the internet and like this generation having the internet at our disposal does put like a whole new scary spin on things. So that's really interesting. But yeah, this does make sense. And the third myth is that children require their teachers to think for them. And before we can understand this, let's go back to bell hooks, who describes our education system as a banking system. The banking system is all about students memorizing and regurgitating information. Students gain knowledge, which can be deposited, stored, and used for later, just like a bank. I really like this analogy.
It's a good one. Yeah. And to be fair, our education system has slowly been shifting away from memorization and more towards application and critical thinking. I think we talked about that all the way back in core curriculum. But the thesis of this idea is that in an equalized power structure, true dialogue is open-ended. And so there's no planned objective that by the end of the lesson, the student should be able to do this or to memorize this. But the core idea of it is that the end result should be unknown and the student learns based on what they ask. And so the focus shifts from memorization and more towards self-developed and self-driven critical thinking skills.
Right. And the example that the author uses is in her English class, students were given a choice to workshop their essays with other students or to have one-on-one meetings with the teacher. Overwhelmingly, students chose to work in small groups amongst themselves and not with the teacher one-on-one.
Yeah. And in the end, though, everything that she had hoped to teach was still taught. She focused on grammar while the other students would ask the exploratory questions about the main topic of the paragraph, about qualifying thoughts, about, you know, what about this? What if this? And this is a quote from the article. The students taught themselves to be excellent writers and readers. And it just goes to show that this method of allowing students to explore and teach themselves and to use their critical thinking skills does still work even in today's classroom.
Yeah, and this is particularly powerful insight in public schools where the teachers are predominantly white women who come from a middle class background, yet teach students who are of color and of low income status. Students should be recognized for their ability and strengths and not constantly being told that they know nothing in comparison to a white authority figure, because those messages, as subvert as they may be, get encoded both for white students and for students of color.
Yeah. And I mean, when I read this article, I thought it was a gem that I found because it really grounded all of the more theoretical thoughts that bell hooks put out. And the equalization of power seems so interesting because that's how I learn in a lot of my book clubs. And I would have loved something like that if I was a kid.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It does feel, I mean, we keep going back, like you keep saying, like how it feels scary and how like kids are so rambunctious. And like it does feel hard to conceptualize because it goes against so much of what does happen in our classrooms. And I even think like a lot of this reminds me of Socratic seminars that we would do in middle school and high school, where it was like we were supposed to be an environment somewhat akin to what is being described, but it was still so like policed and so like who gets to talk this amount of times, like it wasn't an organic conversation. Whereas I feel like in college classes, I mean, of course we are much more mature and we like are wanting to be in these classes, but it's such more like a flowing conversation where everyone gets to get their point across. And I learned so much, not from my professor per se, from the readings and from my peers.
Right. And it's like, honestly, I feel like a big part of it is professors, most of them didn't go to, you know, get an education degree. And so whereas a lot of teachers, part of their education degree is learning classroom management and like how to manage children's behaviors, professors don't get that experience. And I think that kind of says a lot about how we teach teachers to be teachers.
Yeah, absolutely. And it goes back to all of the ideas about control that we were talking about in last episode too. I do think that these things are definitely really linked, a lot of the concepts from last episode, and the racial disparities between teachers and students will come up later in the episode.
Yeah. Well, to further that, let's continue to build upon last episode, because we're going to talk about a bit of a few restorative practices that we can use in the classroom. One of those ways to implement restorative practices are things like community building circles.
Yeah, and community building circles are circles where students get to know each other and their teacher. They're focused on building empathy, and it should happen regularly, not just at the beginning of the year. This reminds me of like writer's workshops, like you were saying, your book clubs, where you do check-ins, like personal check-ins. There's no learning to be done per se. You're just like talking about how your day is going, how your week's going, and you feel like a lot more bonded to your peers and like willing to share with them your intellectual insights, your personal insights. I think it's really important.
Yeah. And it's not just about the check-ins, but it's also, you know, the setting the norms of the classroom. You can have students take part in creating rules, like maybe a student suggests no name calling, or another student suggests, I don't want to use a bathroom pass if I need to go to the bathroom. And this is especially useful when they're thinking about the values of the classroom, like kindness, respect, honesty, because students tend to care more when they're the ones deciding on those values and not just having it come from some adult.
Right. And community circles can also be used to present content. You can focus discussions on topics like English history or science, and can make the material itself part of the community, bring in everyone's own insights and backgrounds and opinions. I think this was what kind of reminded me of the Socratic seminar type situation, except it was never like this. It was very competitive, and people were very wary of bringing in their own perspectives unless they felt the need to dominate.
Or the teacher has to have like a learning objective at the end because it's mandated by the principal in the district, and all that stuff.
I just remember the teacher would always pace back and forth with like a clipboard, and it was like so scary. It was so intimidating.
The last example of could be restorative chats. And this is really tying back to last episode, where instead of lecturing students that break the rules or giving them timeouts, we actually utilize the community to correct what happened. So instead of asking, you know, why did you do this in a very accusatory way, we can ask what happened and have everyone contribute the sides of the story. And then we can ask, what were you thinking at the time? Which is a metacognitive practice to get the students to reflect on their thoughts and emotions that led to that behavior. And then finally, we ask who or what was harmed and how do you repair that harm? So that students can practice identifying, you know, what happened and actually be part of creating that solution. And it's really different than just sending someone to the principal's office.
Totally. And I think this relates to the amount of resources and time that that teachers have with students too, which we're going to talk about later. But we can also talk about teaching tools. So in Fairfax, Virginia, schools have implemented no zero policies so that any incomplete assignments will receive 50s as opposed to zeros, according to the Washington Post. A 0% is pretty hopeless to get your grade up from, whereas a 50% is much more definite. Much more definitely fixable. I think that's a great idea and like empowering for students, because once you have a 0%, it's like, well, that's that. Like, you could just keep getting 0%. Yeah.
even if you get a 0 and then 100 the next time, you're still at a 50. It, yeah, I don't know why this wasn't a thing earlier. Another example, which I've talked about a lot, is standards-based grading. So rather than students starting at 100 and slowly getting points deducted as they miss things, and then they receive a 90 or an 80, in standards-based grading, students are rated on a 1-4 scale. You start at a 1, and as you gain mastery of a skill, it'll slowly go up to a 4 of like advanced mastery.
Right. And you may see rubrics where a 1 means little understanding of a topic and slowly goes up to things like decent understanding, proficient, or advanced. These learning topics are typically written student-friendly language so students can better understand where they need to improve and to get to the next level of mastery.
Yeah. And this can also lead to differentiated learning. So in standards-based grading classrooms, students can be split up into groups based on their mastery level. And then the teacher can better provide targeted instruction based on how well they know the material. So you could pair students all in level 4 and have them work together, or you could pair students at a level 4 with maybe a student at a level 2 and help them. And the world of instruction sort of opens up a little than simply lecturing at someone. And then if they miss something, it's totally their fault.
Totally. And I think like pairing students that are maybe at a different level of learning could be really beneficial, because I think a lot of times that's not the case. And it feels very much like students are categorized and they're like stuck in those circles rather than like having a classroom that kind of interacts together. I mean, certainly there might be instances in which it's best to have students at the same like reading level, for example, in the same group, but mixing that up is also like something that I think doesn't happen so often in classrooms, at least from my experience in schooling. And I think what's most exciting that in some that some the classrooms that do allow students to redo homework and experiments or exams is they get to do it until they get the score that they want. And so what matters is they master the skill and not necessarily that they do super well in a single instance. It's not like everything's on one exam. Of course, everyone has things going on in their lives outside of school that may inhibit that from being the case, doing like getting an A on an exam that you would have maybe gotten an A on if you weren't having something happen in some other part of your life.
Right. And it also, I mean, the language thing definitely matters. Like, you're, it's one thing to say, oh, I keep getting -3 on all my quizzes. And it's another thing to say, you know, currently you're at a proficient level and you really need, like, these are the steps you can take to get to the advanced mastery level. And yeah, I don't know. I like standards-based grading. Some people critique it actually because it can feel very one track, very narrow-minded for the student. Like, oh, I just need to focus on these skills. And that's sort of antithetical to what we were talking about earlier of exploration. But you can do it in the right way. It doesn't have to just be so narrow-minded.
Right. And I do think if they need to focus on the skills that they need to focus on, that's like a beneficial thing, because that would mean that they already mastered the other skills that they might not need to focus on as much. Yeah. And just thinking about starting at 100% and like working down from that, just thinking about that makes me feel like a bank account or something. I guess this isn't the same as like the banking analogy, but kind of like losing money out of your bank account. It's like stressful. It's like, I don't know. That's like what came to mind for me with that.
Yeah, I know. I think I had one class that did SBG, and it was like, if you got a 4, your end grade would be 100. And so for that class, you know, there may have been more students that got hundreds than usual. But the benefit of that was like, A, it helped our GPA by reflecting things, by reflecting our level of understanding, rather than putting pressure on us to be perfect every second of our time in the class.
Right. And also, this would just have to be like a broad sweeping change in education. I mean, this could apply classroom to classroom, except that I feel like usually things are so streamlined in the public education system. And if we're going to talk about things like the SAT and like getting into schools who do look at those grade point averages with the assumption that you were under pressure, like it would have to be a whole reworking of how we think about student-teacher dynamic, how we think about student achievement, which is a lot. But I also think that it's well worth it. I think like there's been so many crazy things that have happened in education, from like just all the different reforms that happen like on a yearly, decade like basis, that it's like worth really revolutionizing, I think, rather than just like constant reform and having like teachers and students drowning in all of it. It gets really confusing, convoluted, and bureaucratic. So I'm for blowing it up.
Yeah.
I'm very for that.
Yeah. Those are things you can do as an individual teacher, but that's a great transition into the impact of teachers. Teachers have a massive impact on all sorts of things on students. And these are not adults that interact with children once or twice, but almost every day for an entire year or a little less than a year, especially for children that are in an important developmental stage.
Totally. And teachers have an incredible impact on children who then, of course, become adults. So it's teachers who affect students on a day-to-day basis, which is certainly something you understand as a student. You know that you're going to see this person every day, which is like a source of, could be total dread, but also like a source of reliability and comfort. But then when you graduate and your hindsight is 20/20, you recognize the effect that a teacher had on you in the long term, I think, if you reflect on it.
Yeah. So here's some positive stats to kick off our conversation. According to weareteachers.com, the average teacher affects over 3,000 students during their careers. That's crazy, because it's not just a student that you teach a lesson to once or twice, but it's a developed relationship unique to almost any other we have in our lives.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to think of another thing that's akin to a teacher, professor. I guess like coach, maybe. I don't, like, it seems like maybe similar, but
maybe
no.
Maybe like pastor?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, for some people, I guess. Not for me, but yeah. Like, that's true. So proof that that developed relationship is a developed one is that according to the same survey, 54% of students say that a teacher has helped them during a difficult time. 75% of students consider teachers as role models. 79% say that a teacher has encouraged them to follow their dreams. 98% of people say that teachers have the ability to change the course of a student's life. And 83% say students say that a teacher has boosted their self-esteem and confidence.
And all of these numbers reveal that many students who then become adults realize the value and appreciate teachers. And I know that both of us can recall a teacher that's memorable, perhaps maybe even changed the course of our lives. And I'm sure we can all remember teachers who we could not stand for whatever reason, maybe could not stand us or just can't get the information across. There's all sorts of teachers that we've had.
Yeah, and I do feel like I can basically remember every teacher that I've ever had. I don't know when that memory will fade from my brain, because I know like my parents cannot, but like I can for now, and I'm going to try to hold on to that. According to the RAND Corporation, among school-related factors, teachers matter most in determining student achievement. Teachers are estimated to have 2 to 3 times the effect of any other school factor, like services, facilities, and even leadership. Not that those things aren't important, but it makes sense because the teacher is a person who the student ultimately relies on and are in proximity to every day. And we've talked about how out-of-school factors completely affect a child's experience in school. So that's not really what we're talking about here. But this is like what's going on within the classroom or within the school environment. Teachers have massive effect, disproportionate to anything else.
Yeah. But what's sad is that oftentimes teacher effectiveness is determined by test scores, which don't really account for the social relationships between students and teachers. Though better test scores may, in fact, reveal a more compelling and caring teacher. So in an Edutopia survey, when people were asked to describe the traits of a life-changing teacher, very few responses were about test scores or academics. Overwhelmingly, people said that a great teacher makes their students feel safe and loved, believed in their students, model patience, and help their students reach their full potential. But these qualities are almost impossible to measure.
Right. And in relation to student achievement, students' long-term success often has less to do with academics than behavior, as well as what's taking place within the family or the community outside of school. According to a study in Sage Journals titled Understanding Why Students Drop Out of High School, according to their own reports, when students drop out of high school, it's usually for disciplinary reasons or factors such as financial issues or family needs, revealing that the best way to keep students in school isn't necessarily to help improve their test scores, but creating a space of belonging and empowerment. In the classroom, this space is built and maintained by teachers.
Right. And on the opposite end of the positive statistics is the fact that teachers have the power to negatively affect a student's self-esteem. Teacher expectations create a reinforcing cycle. So teacher beliefs about students' growth potential shape those teachers' actions, which then in turn impact students' growth, feeding back into teachers' beliefs about students. And often teachers underestimate the abilities of their students because of social attitudes and community prejudices.
Currently, more than 50% of the K through 12 student body in public schools in the United States is made up of individuals of color, reflecting demographic shifts of the last several decades. However, only about 18% of teachers are individuals who identify as Black, Latinx, Asian, Native American, or another non-white group, according to a report by Digital Promise.
Yeah, and that connects to our last episode where we talked about this a bit. But white teachers disproportionately discipline children of color due to learned biases from their life, schooling, and biases embedded in many teacher educational programs. According to a report by Nathaniel Bryan, this dynamic underscores white teacher roles in sustaining such disproportionality in school discipline, as well as extend an intergenerational legacy of negative views of children of color, specifically Black children. And this also socializes white children to believe stereotypical messages that white teachers too received as children. So it's cyclical and plays a part of the teacher crisis, which we will be discussing in a second.
Yeah, and before we get to that, though, we've talked about how important teachers are to individual students and then to adults and then to our society. But with such an important role, what does it take to become a teacher? What kind of schooling, experience, or certification is needed? This information will definitely be helpful if you're thinking about going into education and teaching, but I think it's also good to know what your teachers have done to get where they are and what they've done to earn the right to teach you.
Yeah, so the traditional path to becoming a teacher is first getting a Bachelor's of Arts or Bachelor's of Science in education, but you don't necessarily have to have a degree in teaching. You can get a degree in a non-educational field, maybe something you're interested in teaching, like history or math. And if you don't get a BA in education, or a BS in education, there are alternative certificates like transitional teaching certificates and internship teaching certificates, which offer candidates an alternate route to the classroom, basically partaking in courses that focus strictly on teaching methods rather than educational subjects. And you can also get a post-bac degree in education, which is an additional bachelor's degree without having to start from scratch, or a master's degree in education, which will often net you higher pay than just an undergraduate degree alone.
Then there's certification exams that teachers must take, and this differs by state. For example, in New York, it is the Educating All Students exam, the EDTPA, and the Content Specialty Test in whatever area of certification the individual is planning to teach. Most states and school districts require teachers to have passed the teacher certification exam called Praxis before beginning employment. And then there's everyone's favorite bureaucratic activity, which is fingerprinting and doing all the background information. I had to get fingerprinted for this educational volunteer program that I worked in, and it was like the most governmental building vibes you could ever imagine. Just like long lines, like cranky people, but worth it.
I think I've only been fingerprinted once.
It's like all digital now. I don't know. It feels very outdated because of like the process to do it. But then when you get in there, they have this like crazy, I don't know, this is my experience, like crazy like fingerprinting machine. It's like, let's just update the entire building maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know why we can't just photo scan our fingers into it.
Yeah, there has to be something.
With our phone.
Yeah. Like, why can't I just use my, like, sign into my iPhone for, like, my finger pen? Yeah. I don't know. But that's an important step in becoming a teacher. What's next?
Yeah. So after that, you must complete mentored teaching or student teaching. And this may also come before or before and after certification exams, depending on the state and area. And then once all of this preliminary education, certification, testing, mentor teaching takes place, then you can apply for jobs.
And after you're in the classroom, there are always ways to advance your experience, expertise, and pay as a teacher. The National Center for Education Statistics found in 2011-12 that 56% of public school teachers have a master's degree or higher, and that the base annual salary of those teachers who had their master's degree was almost $11,000 more than the teachers who had a bachelor's. Many teachers obtain their master's degree and professional certification while maintaining their job in the classroom. And
I did not expect that high of a number.
Yeah, I'm not surprised based off like the base salary of teacher pay. But we haven't even talked about this yet, and maybe we'll get to it more. Teachers work so hard. Like, they work so hard. They have such a difficult job. And gaining a master's degree on top of teaching education is absurd. And we'll get more into like compensation for the amount of work that they put in a little bit later. But I know that like my dad is a teacher at a high school. He also got his master's degree while teaching. And it was like late nights studying while teaching in the morning all day and then coaching. Like, but it is part of the reason, I think. I mean, obviously there is this empowerment to further your education regardless of your age, but also the fact that the baseline salary for teachers is very low, and and like it can like in the environment that we live in, like any way to gain more money is often worthwhile. So
If you teach long enough, you can earn tenure, which is a policy that gives professors a permanent contract, ensuring them a guarantee of employment for life or until retirement. For teachers K through 12, it's a little different, but tenure gained traction in the early 20th century as a means of protecting educators from being fired for the wrong reasons, such as personal bias or prejudice from administrators, or teaching out-of-the-box controversial curriculum.
Yeah, and typically academic tenure is granted to university professors only after intensive and protracted process of review and vetting, and professors usually don't come under review for tenure until they've spent at least 5 years on the tenure track position. But primary and secondary school teachers earn tenure at a much shorter time period, sometimes as quick as 3 years. And this statistic kind of surprised me because I always felt like tenure was a hard thing to obtain, and I think it will depend on the school district and the area. I always thought it was literally like 10 years. Like 10 years of teaching, like that's what
that would
you
make
get.
Sense.
Yeah, but I mean, it could, like some places may indeed work like that, but there's a different process, I think, for different school districts and schools and teachers.
Yeah, it also depends on your union. Mm-hmm. And so for teachers, again, it's about unjust firing. And critics will say that teacher tenure makes it hard to fire bad teachers because getting rid of teachers with tenure can involve, you know, years of review, and that's not an understatement, multiple years of review and bureaucratic hurdles, and also can cost tens of thousands of dollars per teacher. And another problem, critics say, is that teachers are not properly evaluated before being granted tenure. Jean Allen, the president of the Center for Education Reform, says that tenure is often no longer based, in most cases, on teacher effectiveness, but instead on their length of service.
Right. And this is like, I think sometimes really upsetting because number one, like teacher effectiveness is also a lot of times based off of test scores, which we also know like isn't necessarily the best way to gauge that. But I think like when you have young teachers genuinely enthusiastic about coming into the teaching workforce and then can't find a job or whatever it may be because there are tenured teachers at the school who may not be as enthusiastic or even like as good of teachers regardless of their experience. But also like these cases are nuanced every single time. Every time there's like a tenured teacher or a new coming teacher, it's like it's dependent on the school. It's dependent on the teacher. Yeah. So it is a tricky, tricky conversation, but definitely important terms to know if you're going into teaching or if you're wondering why this teacher has been at your school for 1,000 years. But we can go back to how much teachers are making, which will lead into our conversation about the teacher crisis and unionization. According to educationdegree.com, in 2020, K-12 teachers made a little bit over 60,000, with high school teachers making the most at 62,870. The salaries were projected to grow by 4%, and I feel like sometimes that's to adjust to inflation, and sometimes it is like mm-hmm. a genuine raise.
Yeah, and actually, this was surprising to me because I was like, 60,000, I feel like that's a little high from everything I've heard. So I did a bit of digging into the National Education Association, which is one of the biggest, one of two of the big teachers unions. And for states like Mississippi, the average salary can be as low as $45,000 for the entire state. So that seems also like, whoa, that's a number I wasn't expecting. But that's also the average, which means there are probably teachers out there making 30,000. And I've definitely heard and seen that. So it's not a lot. And of course, pay will vary by location, as well as the amount of degrees you have. Teachers can also earn additional money from their schools by running after school activities, directing the band, coaching a sport. They can also teach summer school or chaperone school events.
Right. And like those numbers, I think it's really hard to gauge. I was also looking at the median household income of the United States in 2020, mm-hmm. and that was $67,521, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. So I feel like, first of all, teachers are making less than that, but that's also for a household. So you're assuming that there's probably yeah. another income coming in. Regardless, I think in terms of the work, the hours put in, because it's not just the amount of time that kids are at school that teachers are there. It's far before, far after. It's time on the weekends. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of extra time dedicated. And it's also the responsibility, increasingly so, of more and more kids. Like, I don't know what class sizes are right now, but I don't think yeah. the number is a pleasant one.
Yeah. I think for it was the National Center, the NCES, which we cite a lot in all of our episodes, but they reported for 2022 an average salary of like 62,000. But if you actually look at the inflation, teachers are making less now than they did 20 years ago. So,
Yeah, I mean, but you can also say that for like minimum wage and stuff, like in terms of yeah. like equating for inflation and everything. But I think this leads us into the conversation about the teacher crisis.
Yeah. So what is the teacher crisis? Well, the crisis is a shortage of teachers, and it's large and it's growing, especially after COVID and all of these politics that are coming into the classroom, especially when indicators of teacher quality, such as certification, training, and experience are accounted for. Schools in lower socioeconomic areas suffer most. It's a bad thing. And there's a shortage of credentialed teachers in low income areas. And the crisis is getting worse every month.
No, it's not a good conversation to have. It's like scary, honestly, especially because the pandemic has only made things worse and teachers are retiring or quitting the profession due to pandemic era stress. Nationally, there were 575,000 fewer local and state education employees in October 2021 than February 2020, according to the latest job report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
That's insane. That's a huge decrease.
Yeah, but I'm also thinking this is education employees, and I'm wondering who is included in that statistic, because I feel like if there's people who lost their jobs because they work at schools in person and they're no longer needed, yeah. such as like custodial, or I'm not sure. But regardless, sense. It's a huge, huge decrease. Yeah.
Yeah. So none of this sounds good, but what are the direct implications of having less teachers? Because there certainly is no shortage of students.
Right. So different schools and different districts have taken different approaches to dealing with staffing shortages. For instance, three schools in Ann Arbor, Michigan have added back remote learning days to deal with staffing shortages. And in Seattle and Bellevue, Washington, schools have given students Fridays off because of staffing shortages.
More than that, the fact that this impacts low-income schools, students, and communities the hardest, it hinders moves towards educational equity, which we've talked about in past episodes, as it connects to equity outside of the classroom.
Also, high teacher turnover consumes economic resources that would be put towards investing in other developments in education, such as more mental health professionals in schools, which we've brought up before. The shortage also makes it harder to build a reputation for teachers and to professionalize it, which further contributes to perpetuating the shortage as put by the Economic Policy Institute.
Yeah, so there are nuanced reasons for the teacher shortage. The first that comes to mind is lack of compensation and respect for the amount of work that goes into the profession. In relation to the pandemic, there are health risks and challenges with technology, like the often defeating task of attempting to teach students over Zoom. But there are other reasons too. The education equity advocacy nonprofit Stand for Children released a new national survey of teachers that find that 3 in 10 teachers are considering leaving the profession at the end of the school year. And more than a third of the 2,000 K-12 educators surveyed cited as a reason new state laws restricting classroom discussions on race, gender, and sexuality.
Of the teachers surveyed, 37% said that the push for the laws that prevent honest teaching and conversation in their classrooms would make them more likely to leave teaching at the end of the school year, which is super upsetting and something, I mean, obviously you hear in the news all the time about these laws or just the controversies over critical race theory or whatever that's been blown up to mean to different political groups. But I really hadn't thought of that as affecting teachers' will to teach, but I get it. Like, I understand it now because I feel like these restrictions are just kind of like just an assault on the craft of teaching. Like, I do think that you have first of all your unique philosophy around teaching in the world that you're not allowed to like convey to your students. It's like censorship in the classroom. Jonah Edelman, the executive officer at Stand for Children, said there is a direct connection between states pushing for censorship laws and teachers' willingness to stay in the teaching profession, and students and families are paying the price. So, I mean,
yeah. I mean, what can illustrate this pretty crazy is Florida's Don't Say Gay bill, which is very recent. And there's a teacher that was very public about he had to choose between taking down a picture of him and his husband or getting fired as a teacher. And it's like it was the one thing that he could have on his desk that reminded him of his partner while he was away. So, yeah, not a very grim situation that's continuing to get grimmer. And baked into all of this is the crisis about around hiring and retaining teachers of color in order to diversify the teaching workforce to better reflect the student body of the United States. The importance of this was discussed in our last episode and in previous episodes about educational equity.
As of 2018, individuals of color accounted for only 18% of the total teaching workforce. And this is statistics that we mentioned previously in the episode.
Yeah, and though this is a nationwide phenomena, regions and groups vary. So one stark statistic is that African-American men make up only 2% of the entire teacher workforce, even though African-Americans make up at least 16% of the student population. And it's information from the same report, but overall, 3/4 of teachers from elementary to high school are women, and a majority identifying as white.
Additionally, students of color obtaining bachelor's degrees are largely not choosing to study education. Also, the growing cost of college education and college debt push students away from careers with little pay and towards ones with more lucrative payoff, which makes complete sense, and teaching is not one of those.
Definitely. I mean, it's not like people go into teaching for money, but the fact that money is such a limiting factor is contributing hardcore to this shortage.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point.
Okay, so there are some amazing organizations working to aid the shortage of teachers and teachers of color, to name a few. Teach for America and Citizen Schools focus on educational equity, but the recruitment of passionate individuals committed to education and diversity is a cornerstone to their work. And it also helps inspire a passion for children, teaching, and community.
There's also IRT, which is the Institute for Recruitment of Teachers, which addresses the lack of diversity in the nation's teaching faculties by recruiting students of color, counseling them through graduate school application processes, and advocating for sufficient funding for their advanced study. If you're interested in going into teaching and learning more about the teacher crisis or educational equity and want to learn more about these organizations, check out these websites, which will be linked in the show notes. Should we move on to teachers' unions? Because I'm interested.
Yes.
I'm interested.
Oh, yes. So teachers' unions are a very hot topic. And a union, if you don't know, is a collective group of workers, in this case teachers, that work together to protect each other and fight higher-ups like CEOs or, in teachers' case, administrators. And collective bargaining is a huge plus of a union, where the union workers collectively bargain for higher wages or better benefits. And while teachers' unions are legal everywhere, collective bargaining is outlawed in 5 states: Texas, Georgia, North and South Carolina, and Virginia. So as we talk through collective bargaining, if you're in one of those states, just remember that.
Forget about it, yeah. Collective bargaining for teachers is also restricted in Idaho, Indiana, Michigan, Tennessee, and Wisconsin. Why is that bad? Because once restrictions hit these states, total teacher compensation dropped about 6% of teachers' salaries and dropped about 6%. Teachers' salaries dropped about 5%, and teachers' benefits dropped nearly 10%. Without proper collective bargaining, teachers are disempowered to and taken advantage of.
Exactly. So according to Terry Moe in his article, Teachers' Unions and America's Public Schools, the vast majority of public school teachers are union members either to the NEA, which I just talked about, or the American Federation of Teachers, AFT. And from 1961 to 2009, membership in NEA grew from 766,000 to over 3.2 million members. So it's safe to say that teachers' unions are most likely affecting your life.
Definitely. In Michigan, for example, over 94% of teachers are covered by collective bargaining, which means if you are a teacher in Michigan, they're probably being paid more thanks to their union. According to 2 studies, one by William Baugh and Joe Stone and the other by Caroline Hawksabee, teachers covered by collective bargaining earn 5 to 12% more than those not covered.
Yeah, that's a significant amount, especially for teachers. And in my home state of Texas, teachers in Houston, Dallas, San Antonio are heavily unionized, but they can't collectively bargain for higher salaries. So what do you do in that situation? These unions work to change district policies and regulations in order to better provide benefits for teachers. So it's not just about the money, but it also is probably affecting local politics too.
That's really interesting that you mentioned Texas, which is known for being pretty conservative. Unions are often villainized in conservative states, but even in conservative states, 60 to 70% of teachers are unionized. They don't have to, nor are they forced to, but they do, because it also is a form of protection. I mean, I guess we're talking about being taken advantage of, but like serious, like other forms of protection too, I feel like.
Yeah. And that totally makes sense. Part of the working conditions that they may be getting if they're part of a union is, or things that they're just thinking about are class size, preparation time for lesson materials, and other activities that increase teachers' autonomy. And these things are always being negotiated. So Randall Ebert has an article called Teachers' Unions and Student Performance, and it shows that student-teacher ratios are 7 to 12% lower for union teachers than non-union teachers. They also have more prep time before school and during the morning. They limit administrative duties and parent meetings, which all happen outside of work hours. So it's a lot better in terms of working conditions if you're in a union.
Yeah. And union members are also protected from temporary downturns in enrollment. They're granted tenure, like we said before, which just means that teacher can't be fired without due process. In other words, you can't get fired for something as arbitrary or performance-based, and the administration has to take proper steps to dismiss you.
Yeah. So teachers' unions are very popular for teachers, and they're popular in both liberal and conservative states. So why did we say in the beginning that it's a hot topic and that it's controversial?
Well, there are some negatives. These benefits may result in higher cost. Operating costs for unionized elementary school are about 15% higher than non-unionized schools. This could raise taxes on the local community or change how schools allocate their resources. For example, a school may have to cut extracurricular funding in order to fulfill their unionized teacher benefits.
Right. And longer contracts could mean that, like we mentioned earlier, a problematic teacher will take longer to dismiss. But I feel like the benefits still outweigh these costs, wouldn't you say?
I think so. And I think another reason why unions are controversial is because, or like teacher unions are controversial, is because unions are controversial. And I think they represent a lot of things outside of their cost-benefit analysis. I think they represent a lot of things politically speaking too. Mm-hmm. I also think that the fact that the taxes would be raised is always a flag for controversy. What may be more interesting is the effect that the teachers' union have on student performance, which is something I've never really considered before. According to Ebert, students in union districts have their standardized exam scores raised by 1-2% and about 5% before and after testing, which is great, except that that's only true for average achieving students.
Right. And that was sort of a confusing statistic to read, but it was across four different samples by four different surveys by the SES, the HSB, the NAEE, and the NELS. It's too long to say all those, not in acronym form, so just look in the show notes. But you can see on the curve that for low and high performing students, they did kind of worse. And it's the opposite reaction for average achieving students. And in addition, Hawksbee measured a 2.3% increase in high school dropout rates for unionized schools. So I don't necessarily know, the article didn't really go in detail about the causation of why the benefits only happen in like the middle part of the curve, but it's interesting nonetheless, and it is empirical evidence.
Yeah, I'm wondering what you make of those statistics, because I'm like trying to think of what I make of those statistics too, especially when thinking about if teachers' unions are good or bad. I mean, I think it's complicated, and I think unions are complicated because there's certainly unions that, you know, kind of abuse the system. I can think of several. But there's also unions that are absolutely necessary in ensuring pay. And I'm really like excited about different unionized efforts that are happening in terms of freelance workers like Uber or different things that are happening around that. But it's interesting, like thinking about how they're good for teachers, but not so much certain students, and the effect that student performance has largely been part to like school reform. It's largely a part of that, but that's changing.
Yeah. And so like what that means is teachers' unions have mostly been involved in salaries and stuff and not necessarily the policies happening in the school itself or in the learning objectives set by administrators. But these days, teachers' unions are slowly but surely getting into that realm, working with administrators to determine performance metrics, working with them to develop professional development objectives, and collaborating with districts to have joint responsibility in students' well-being. So that may be a reason why some students do a little worse in teachers' unions, teacher unionized schools, because the policies themselves at those schools are conformist and not necessarily differentiated enough to help those students. So yeah, that's what I think of that. And I feel like that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I also think I'm not totally sure how much teacher unionization really does affect student
outcome.
And I think like I am definitely one to advocate for like what's happening with the students. We should talk about what's going on in the classroom instead of like these more political issues that really have nothing to do with what's going on in the classroom. But it seems to me that teachers' unions are ultimately about the teachers and teacher pay compensation yeah. and what's going on for teachers. And of course that does, of course it does come back to the students, but I think the workforce is like important, and that's what the unions are really for. And I really don't know
yeah.
if it matters, if it like, unless it like drastically like changes student experience, which it doesn't seem like it does. It just seems like it makes it more equitable for teachers.
Yeah. I think it's such a small difference in testing scores that it's negligible. And it's also testing scores, which are problematic.
I know. And we've always said like testing scores mean yeah. something, but what do they actually mean? Do we want to end with some closing thoughts and where we go from here, knowing everything that we've said about the teacher crisis, about teacher pay, about teacher impact? Like, what are some of your takeaway thoughts from this episode?
Yeah, I mean, my takeaway thoughts are, you know, if you're a student, there are some things you can do in terms of organizing and whatnot. I think just giving them grace during this time is honestly the most important thing you can do. And as a teacher, I feel like there's so much more to talk about from this episode, especially like the tools that you use, the frameworks in your classroom, how you grade students, how you enforce discipline, the extent to which you police, if at all, students. There's just so much you can do as a teacher to completely change a student's life, even if it's just for that 1 year. But 1 year as a student is a long time. So yeah, maybe if you're a student, send these things over to teachers and administrators. Maybe they'll listen to it or like read about it or something.
I think like the impact section, or the section in which we talked about the amount of impact that teachers have on students, like definitely got to my head just thinking about like 3,000 students on average over the course of a lifetime. And it's not just like, you know, you see them, you like really connect with them. Yeah. And I do think that kind of every act, and this is a lot of pressure to put on one single teacher, but, you know, all your actions toward your students matter in terms of like their developmental psychology, which is mm-hmm. like crazy to think about. But yeah, just being super intentional in the classroom with all of those things involving behavior and, of course, content, but especially just in creating safe environments in which these students are going to take these skills and the knowledge that they've taken from you as a human being with them further in life is like important to remember. But I don't think any teacher doesn't know those yeah. things. I just do think that there's ways to rethink how we do approach students.
Yeah. One thing we didn't talk about that I could not fit in here was the alternative systems of like sharing that teachers have right now because of the internet. As a teacher, if you join a group, it's so easy to find like teaching materials from other teachers, and it's like tried and true methods, and it saves a lot of prep time. There's teachers sharing, you know, the techniques we talked about earlier, restorative practices, all sorts of things to change the education system from the teacher side. And so if you're a teacher and you haven't joined one of those learning communities, definitely do so, because, you know, there are a lot of things that are incomplete about a degree. I know in my degree, I feel like I'm not able to say I'm an expert on music, but as a teacher, sort of the same thing. Like, you're not an expert on pedagogy. There's so many things out there to make it a little easier on students of color and low-income students.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, and there's always new things to learn and to the new ways to connect to your students that are published and shared. I will also just plug Dawn for a bunch of resources. The Diverse Fire Narrative website has a bunch of resources for both students, but definitely teachers as well, mm-hmm. lesson plans, and that center people of color and students of color and authors of color. And if you're looking for a quick resource, that is one that we will always link in the show notes. So definitely check that out as well.
Yeah. Are you watching Abbott Elementary on Hulu?
Should I be? I'm not.
you should definitely be. Everyone listening to this episode should be watching it. It's so funny, and the kids are hilarious, and the teachers are so relatable. It's funny.
I think that is a good book segment that you just did, because I don't have a book to share this week, but I think your Abbott Elementary shout out is very perfect to end our episode.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if I'm doing it, I'm going to refer to the book we mentioned all the way back in the beginning, which is Teaching to Transgress, and then complement that with Abbott Elementary. And those two will set you up for a wonderful weekend of funny and thought-provoking.
Wow. I think you just topped every book segment that I did. This, like, coupling. I love it. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. We hope that you enjoyed our 12th episode. That seems crazy to me. But
yeah. All right. Bye. Thanks for listening to the podcast. You can find us on Instagram at DiversifyOurNarrative, or you can go to DiversifyOurNarrative.com, where you can find resources, educational content, and more. Special thanks to Feel the Ambiances for our music. And don't forget to rate 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify.